Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a video by Reformed Christian Teaching, in which they tell us how the Bible explains known science in less than 5 minutes. Well, if I could just give my initial less than 5 minute rebuttal to just the title of the video, I find it interesting that the Bible only ever seems to explain already known science to us, and the science that can be found in the Bible progresses at a slightly slower pace than actual modern science, as though the theologians figure out how to fit the new science into the old Bible. You'd think that if there was science to be found in the Bible would be at the forefront of scientific discovery instead of trailing behind it. But let's see where he goes.
English philosopher Herbert Spencer died in 1903. He was famous for applying scientific discoveries to philosophy. Herbert Spencer was awarded some accolades because he came up with this. He said there are five knowable categories in the natural sciences. Five knowable categories: time, force, motion, space, and matter.
I actually can't find much about Herbert Spencer contributing that to science, but it's not that important to the point, so I didn't do a deep dive or anything. But this is the same Herbert Spencer that basically founded social Darwinism. Now, there is some debate about whether he can really be blamed for the rise of social Darwinism, as it was kind of a thing that grew out of his ideas without him directly advocating for it himself. But while he is definitely an important philosophical and scientific figure, he also had some pretty yikes ideas. Not that these five knowable categories in natural sciences are a yikes idea, but since our modern understanding of space-time wasn't articulated until 1907, 4 years after Spencer's death, I do have my doubts about the completeness and modern relevance of this specific observation.
However, Genesis 1 says, "In the beginning, that's time, God, that's force, created, that's motion, the heavens, that's space, and the earth, that's matter."
Couple things here. First and foremost, did you think that defining these as scientifically knowable categories is the same thing as just being a normal person who uses language and intuitively understands certain concepts? Did you think that before Spencer came along and defined them as scientifically knowable, that it was impossible to use language to describe them? Did you think that before 1903, people didn't write or talk about entities doing things in time and having stuff happen? Like, seriously? "Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried." That has all five as well. Time is now, force is made, motion is buried, space is York, and matter is the deep bosom of the ocean. Like, did you honestly think that before 1903 people didn't understand these concepts? What Spencer's contribution was the articulation of the idea that these five categories are the ones that we are measuring when we are doing science. Genesis 1:1 did not articulate that these are the categories that scientists measure. It simply used these categories in an intuitive way, same as people have been doing since language was invented. I don't need the Bible or Spencer to tell me that I experience events in an order, or that I need to exert force to move something, or that how much force I need to exert is dependent upon the size, shape, and mass of the thing that I am attempting to move, or that stuff exists, or that it exists in physical space. Secondly, the way you broke that up is a bit of a stretch. Sure, in the beginning is time, and I would be willing to concede God as a force if we want, and creating stuff out of nothing certainly would get things moving, so that can be motion, but when Spencer was talking about space, I would be very surprised indeed if I were to learn that he was just thinking of outer space and not the physical dimensions in which things exist occupying space. So while the heavens definitely do take up space, you'd have a hard time arguing that space in the sense of just a three-dimensional plane of existence wouldn't also be covered by the existence of the Earth. And likewise, there's a lot of matter in outer space, so why are the heavens space and the Earth matter when it could work just as well the other way around? Well, by all appearances, it seems to be that way because that's just the way we intuitively understand it because of the ambiguity around the word space. In other words, it's just a sentence in a book that has nothing to do with this scientific concept, but you decided to shoehorn this scientific concept into it anyway, even though it doesn't quite fit, and can be shoehorned just as well into any number of other non-scientific works of literature. In fact, I can find these five categories in the opening stanza of the Enuma Elish quite easily. If there's anything to this line of thinking, then the Enuma Elish got there first, since it definitely predates the Genesis creation story. So, what does this mean? Does this mean that the first text we can find that happens to use all five of these concepts must have been given to us by a supernatural deity? Do the texts that are earlier than the Bible not count for some reason? Or is this whole argument maybe just a big, huge load of crap because just having an intuitive understanding of physics is in no way comparable to having a scientific understanding of physics?
You're only one verse in the Bible, and that is all laid out.
But it's not laid out, though. It's not saying that those are the five knowable categories. It is just using language which will make use of these categories whether the person using the language understands what Spencer was getting at or not. If it were all laid out, then why did it take us several thousand years between it being laid out clearly and us actually figuring it out? Okay, I've seen some Christian audiences laugh at some pretty terrible jokes, and I usually don't comment on it, but I didn't even know that was supposed to be a joke. Why are they laughing? I can usually tell when a preacher is expecting a laugh, but I legit had no idea that there was supposed to have been a punchline there. Maybe hearing Hovind use almost this exact argument so many times has just jaded me to the humor of the situation? But not even Hovind expects a laugh there. He says it like it's a profound realization, not a joke. This is bothering me more than it should.
Sorry, Herbert.
See? Now that is a not funny preacher joke that actually comes across as a joke. I get that one.
You'll find that the Bible is accurate when it intersects with modern scientific concepts.
I think you'll find that usually the opposite is true unless you spend a lot of time twisting the text away from what it is obviously saying. That's why young Earth creationists are a thing. They've decided to take the Bible at its word in opposition to most of modern science because they believe the Bible is accurate on scientific concepts even when science disagrees. Sure, you can sometimes find stuff that might look like it'll fit with modern science, like that verse in Job about God hanging the earth on nothing, and if we ignore the fact that hanging makes it sound like the earth is suspended against a force of gravity that would pull it downward, this can kinda look like a verse that's affirming that the earth is floating through the void of space. And we also have to ignore the fact that empty space is not nothing, so hanging the earth on nothing isn't really a scientific description of orbital mechanics unless you do a lot of stretching. But let's just pretend that this isn't a problem by itself. We have one verse that says the earth exists as it does. Now, what do we do with the several verses that talk about the earth having foundations? Why does the one verse that looks like it might be scientifically accurate if you interpret it loosely enough take precedence over the dozen or so verses that talk about the earth having physical foundations? And that's not even getting into the rules around various medical problems found in the Bible, most of which are completely unsanitary, and even the one that people like Ray Comfort like to point to as instructing you to wash your hands with running water to keep clean doesn't actually tell you to do that until after you've been healed of your discharge for a week. It's not like the Bible says to wash up before eating, and it's actually pretty easy to interpret as saying the exact opposite of that.
It has to be because the author of the Bible knows the way things really are.
I assume here that when you say author of the Bible, you mean God, since the Bible didn't have just one author. This sounds like motivated reasoning to me. You start with the conclusion that the Bible must be accurate, and then go Bible spelunking to find verses that might look like they are scientifically accurate if you think about them in just the right way, and usually ignore the larger context.
Isaiah 40:26 says it is God who created the universe, and he holds the stars together by his power, and not one of them is ever missing.
So, stars never die? Is that what that verse says? Because life on Earth would literally not even be possible if stars didn't die. Forget life on Earth, the Earth itself wouldn't exist if stars didn't die. The universe would just be a collection of stars and the occasional loose cloud of hydrogen, helium, and lithium. Maybe beryllium too, though my understanding is that the beryllium that resulted from the Big Bang nucleosynthesis would have been unstable and decayed, so maybe not. Also, supernovae exist. They are a thing. you can see the remnants of them for yourself with just consumer-grade telescopes. The star that existed before becoming SN1987A went missing. It is no longer there.
In this way, the Bible suggests the first law of thermodynamics, that ultimately nothing is ever destroyed.
Wow, that is not where I expected that to go. That is way more of a reach than I thought you were going for. Bold move. No stars ever go missing somehow equals the total energy of an isolated system remains constant. If this is the kind of stretch that can make science fit into the Bible, then no wonder some people are so adamant that the Bible is scientifically accurate, because that isn't even close.
Ecclesiastes 1:10, is there anything of which one might say, see this, it is new? The answer immediately follows, already it has existed for ages which were before us.
See, now that is less of a reach for the first law of thermodynamics than the no stars go missing verse. It's still a stretch, but now instead of being a physically impossible stretch, you just need to have Elastigirl's powers. Which, I guess, is still physically impossible, but I think you know what I mean.
Ancient writers of the Bible, thousands of years before the laws of thermodynamics had been categorically stated, were affirming the conservation of mass and energy.
Yeah, remember when I said that you need to ignore the context of these verses in order to give them scientific meaning? The book of Ecclesiastes is rather nihilistic in nature, pointing out that nothing has eternal meaning, everything is ultimately going to be meaningless, so just take joy in the simple pleasures of day-to-day life. There is nothing new under the sun is a repeating motif throughout the book, and it is never used in the sense of the first law of thermodynamics.
The second law of thermodynamics states that although mass and energy are always conserved, they nevertheless are breaking down and going from order to disorder, cosmos to chaos, system to non-system.
That is not even close to what the second law of thermodynamics states. Scientific laws are worded very specifically, and this is intentional. If it were phrased as you have just stated it, its application would be too broad and there would be too many exceptions, so it wouldn't actually qualify as a scientific law. Usually, scientific laws are not even fully applicable to the real world. There will be too many confounding factors, but rather they represent how things would behave in idealized conditions. They are usually generally applicable, but if you look too closely, you'll notice that the application is imperfect because the situation is imperfect.
The Bible, contrary to the theory of evolution, affirms that.
See? The theory of evolution is one of those areas where the second law of thermodynamics just isn't applicable. But actually, it kind of is applicable, but not in the way that creationists like. You see, thermodynamics is about the total energy of systems and how it will behave. The second law of thermodynamics is pretty much just about heat transfer. It's actually one of the more complicated of the thermodynamic laws, so it's hard to accurately sum up in simple statements, but basically, in an isolated system, heat will always flow from the warmer body to the colder body. The terms order and disorder, thermodynamically speaking, do not mean the same thing that we mean when we look at, say, a messy room. Also, they kind of are. An ordered system is one where the warmer and colder molecules are separated, and they are organized together. Disorder is when they get all mixed up, and thereby making the hotter area colder and the colder area hotter. So if we look at life, if you take some life and put it in an isolated system with some resources, the life will use these resources to sustain its metabolism. But once the resources run out and metabolism stops, the system would be in thermal equilibrium. There's no more heat concentrated in the living thing, just thermal equilibrium. And the presence of the living thing made that process happen faster than if the life had not been there. So life is actually an efficient thermodynamic mechanism for increasing the entropy of a system. As life evolves and becomes more complex, it becomes more efficient at increasing entropy. So it's entirely possible that life is an expected outcome of the second law of thermodynamics as a mechanism for efficient entropy increase. And I haven't even gotten into the whole the Earth isn't actually an isolated system by any stretch of the imagination thing yet, nor the living systems are not isolated systems either, and in fact require external energy input in order to function arguments.
As matter breaks down and energy dissipates, ultimately the world and the universe as we know it will head toward destruction.
I mean, destruction isn't really a good way to describe it, but yeah, the heat death of the universe is coming. And remember, life increases entropy faster than not life, so life is making the heat death come faster, and the more active the life is, the more entropy it will increase during its lifetime. What I'm trying to say is that I'm not lazy. I'm just doing my part to delay the heat death of the universe. You're welcome.
And it will be unable to reproduce itself.
The universe will? I didn't know people thought the universe was a reproducing organism. I mean, I'm sure there's some new age woo thing about it or something. I mean, we all know that guy who thinks they've made some important discovery by saying that solar systems look a little bit like our typical representation of an atom. So what if we're all just atoms in an even bigger universe than ours or whatever? But I know of no scientific findings that would indicate anything about our universe reproducing itself. Unless maybe that's you misunderstanding the bouncing cosmology model? I wouldn't call that reproduction, but I could at least see how you might consider it a form of reproduction.
Romans 8 says this is the creation groaning under its curse.
What is the fact that the universe doesn't reproduce? Are you saying that the universe would reproduce if it weren't for those pesky humans eating the wrong fruit? What is even happening here?
The science of hydrology studies the cycle of water, consisting of three major phases: evaporation, condensation, precipitation. Clouds move over the land, drop water through precipitation, the rain runs into creeks, the creeks to streams, the streams to the sea. Evaporation process takes place in the ocean, and the cycle goes on.
Okay, that is the closest you've come to saying something scientifically accurate, so that would be a good place for you to leave it. You're definitely not going to go to Job now to argue that the author of Job was writing about the water cycle, right? Because ultimately those verses are easily explained by the fact that, you know, people notice that it rains when there are clouds, which is something that I'm sure the ancient Hebrews were perfectly capable of noticing, and they wouldn't have needed revelation from God to explain that.
Ecclesiastes 1, Isaiah 55 present that water cycle. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again.
Okay, staying out of Job. You surprised me again. Well done. Usually apologists are a lot more predictable than this. But yeah, this is another basic observation about the world. Rivers flow to the sea. Do you think the ancient Hebrews were inept enough to have needed divine revelation in order to figure out what direction water flows in?
Ecclesiastes 1:7, the rain, the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth.
Again, yeah, the water returned to heaven could be interpreted as evaporation, but while the water cycle as we understand it today wasn't described until about the 1500s, the ancient Greeks most definitely had a concept of evaporation, and again, you must have a pretty low opinion of the ancient Hebrews if you think that they would have been completely oblivious to the fact that puddles disappear all by themselves sometimes.
Isaiah 55. Job 36 speaks of evaporation, condensation.
Ah, there it is. I wasn't completely wrong. Yay?
He, God, draws up the drops of water. They distill rain from the mist, which the clouds pour down. They drip upon men abundantly.
Ooh, that sounds hot.
It was the 1500s when Copernicus presented the idea the earth was in motion. People were astounded.
Yeah, and the people who wrote the Bible would have been astounded too, what with all their talk of the foundations and whatnot.
17th century, Kepler and Galileo give birth to modern astronomy. That time, people thought there were 1,000 stars. The number of stars, says Genesis 22, is equal to the number of grains of sand on the seashore.
Firstly, that's not actually what it says. It says that God will give Abraham as many offspring as there are grains of sand and stars in the heaven. So we could look at this as the Bible saying that those numbers are either equal, or we could say that those numbers are to be added together. And lucky for you that it doesn't actually explicitly equate the two, because I was all ready to go with how there are actually several orders of magnitude more stars in the observable universe than there are grains of sand on the earth, and there are definitely way more stars in the universe if we're including the parts that we can't see. And on top of that, this verse had better be hyperbolic if you don't want to get into how ridiculous it would be to say that one person would have more descendants than there are stars in the sky. If the entire human race were descended from Abraham, he'd only be at about 100 billion descendants by now, several orders of magnitude too few, and it would take a long-ass time to make up the difference. Maybe that's why the apocalypse hasn't happened yet. God's just sitting up there waiting until the total population of humans descended from Abraham passes the number of stars in the sky before the second coming. Well, bad news, Christians. If that's what God's waiting for, you've probably got several billion more years to wait at least.
Jeremiah 33:22 says stars can't be counted.
I mean, we'll likely never have an actual count where someone went through and manually counted each individual point of light. The numbers we arrive at are estimates based on averages, so it really depends on what you mean by counted here. Will we never know how many there are? Our estimates get us pretty close. Will we never know the exact number? I'd agree with that. But ultimately, this isn't a scientific tidbit in the Bible. This is the result of humans looking up at a sky before light pollution was the problem, and seeing more things there than they would be able to count themselves, so then writing that it's impossible to count them.
The host of heaven cannot be counted, the sand of the sea cannot be measured, so I will multiply the descendants of David.
Again, this is hyperbole, not science.
We've calculated millions upon millions of stars, even today.
Well, there's actually a lot more than that. But you won't find any actual estimates about the number in the Bible, because it's not a science book, and very little of scientific relevance can even be found in it. And most of what is there is entirely wrong, and the rest is not being any further advanced in knowledge than the other cultures of the time.
The oldest book in the Bible, Book of Job, says in Job 26:7, he hangs the earth on nothing.
There it is. Do you know, I actually had a really hard time earlier in this video trying to paraphrase that verse in a way that would actually make it sound scientifically accurate. When I decided to hypothetically grant it as being scientifically accurate, I kept writing it out, realizing the scientific inaccuracies I included in that version of the paraphrase, and then having to delete it and start over. Eventually, I had to settle for saying that this verse says that the Earth exists as it does.
We have one verse that says the Earth exists as it does.
Because every other iteration introduced obvious inaccuracies.
He hangs the earth on nothing. That's a lot better than other religious sacred books that say it's on the backs of elephants that produce earthquakes when they shake.
Yeah, but the threshold for being scientifically accurate is not just being better than a different inaccurate religious text. It is accurately describing reality. The Book of Job does not accurately describe reality, and therefore it is not scientifically accurate. Again with the laughing at the non-joke. This guy doesn't even look like he is aware that he told the joke, and yet the congregation laughs. I know getting a church congregation to laugh is an easy thing to do, but this dry-ass boring sermon shouldn't be doing the trick, even for a church congregation. Dude's making me think I have a future in stand-up comedy.
Job also said in Job 38:14 that the earth is turned like the clay to the seal. It's rotated.
This verse is talking about how the world changes between day and night. When there's light, the earth's features stand out. The earth went from being featureless like a hunk of clay at night to having features as a hunk of clay that has had the cylinder seal rolled over it during the day. First and foremost, if you want to take this passage as scientific truth, then that means that the Earth literally becomes featureless at nighttime. Secondly, it makes more sense that they would be making analogies and metaphors using technology that they had at the time, such as, you know, cylinder seals, than that they are actually talking about the rotation of the Earth. Also, as long as we're in the general vicinity of Job, just a couple verses earlier, it talks about the ends of the Earth. Which part of a sphere is its end, I wonder?
In those days, soft clay was used for writing and a seal was used for applying one's signature. It rotated on its axis and embedded that signature into the soft clay.
Yes, but let's pay better attention to the analogy here. The earth was most definitely the clay in the analogy, which would then make the seal the firmament, or the sky, if you will. This makes it look like they thought the sky rotated around the earth with this interpretation, which checks out, but it's not scientifically accurate. And that's the end of it. Well, I must say, at least I was surprised a few times in this one. This apologist is keeping it fresh. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Thinbox Dictator, who says, "That straight line argument is so stupid. It's like the idea of a triangle exists, therefore a perfect triangle has to exist. Just no." I think Plato would like to have a word with you, sir. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Lynn Dobbs, Mark McManus, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the cylinder seals that shape the clay that is my channel. If you'd like to roll all over me and get me all up in your cracks and crevices, then you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description. If you'd like to listen to my videos in podcast form, the link for that is also in the description, as well as links to my social media accounts and my P.O. Box address. See you next time!